Okay, welcome back, and we're going to continue our program this morning. The agenda for this morning is the next session, which we have called the plenary session, and we will be dealing with establishing the time of death in halakha. Looking at it from a different point of view, this is really the issue of the controversy of brain death and brainstem death and cardiac death, respiratory death. This has been, for those of you following the literature, probably one of the most controversial issues in the past 12 months. And I very much appreciate the speakers that we have had, that we are going to be having this morning to discuss this. I'm very proud to be involved with Jay and Torin Motion, because essentially there's some issues that need to be discussed, and last year we were able to tackle some of those very difficult issues head on. This year again, this has come up as a very significant controversial issue in the Orthodox world, and it spreads beyond the Orthodox world because it involves issues that involve all of humankind and relatives that are perhaps not necessarily Orthodox or non-Orthodox, and it has implications in terms of the family planning. The Mishnah tells us that a person who is learning the hamastik, and then suddenly he takes a break, and he says, how beautiful is this tree? The Mishnah tells us that he is actually culpable for death. And what does the seemingly looking at a beautiful tree have to do with being culpable for death? And the idea that the Maharal explains is that if one is learning and then suddenly stops learning and then suddenly says that nature is beautiful, then that individual has missed the point. There's a disconnect between the learning and the science. What we are trying to do here this weekend, and today in particular, is to try to understand the science. This is not an emotional discussion about brain death, although of course it is, but it's going to be a discussion which is going to try to understand the nature of it. I'm giving this introduction because I want to make sure that we are all on the same page. The idea is not to walk out of here in the next 90 minutes or so, or perhaps longer, with an idea that says, oh, I know all the psak, that's it, it's impossible. It will be absolutely impossible to discuss this. We can probably spend more than a weekend going over the basics, the physiology, the understanding besides the anatomy, the physiology, and then getting into the halacha. And we can do halacha analysis and whether the pshat follows the opinion of which text Rashi was using or which text Rashi was not using, and the authenticity of which tshuva of Rav Moshe we're looking at, whether it's this chalik or that chalik, and did he really mean that or not. So the goals have to be set forth early in the morning and then to try to guide us. And for that, we have a panel of scholars and speakers that will be able to address that. So the concept is to try to get a flavor and an understanding of what goes into it. And I know that each of the speakers will tell you themselves, you will need to consult with the Rav, but ultimately the Rav needs to understand the medicine, the physiology, and to be able to make this kind of a decision. And my only comment in terms of organizing a little bit of this is I would like to, if you can impart this on some of your Rabbanim that you deal with, it would be nice for them to come to these kind of discussions as well. This is not just for the medical people, for the lay people, but the rabbinic leadership needs to be at these type of interactions where they hear from the experts what it's all about. So with that type of an introduction, allow me, for those of you that I did not yet introduce, Rabbi Glatt, who were in the other session. Rabbi Glatt will be discussing this morning, and I want to thank him because he's going to be taking on one of the more greater challenges this morning, which is the controversial topic of the RCA statement. Now, the RCA statement is something that some of you may have seen and have been reading about, and we're not going to go through the 114 pages of the document. The idea is to get an understanding of it. Rabbi Glatt last year took on one of these challenges, and he has accepted again to take this challenge this year to be able to discuss the RCA document with some sort of perspective. Now, to do so, Rabbi Glatt is an assistant rabbi at Young Israel of Woodmere. He is the president and CEO of St. Joseph's Hospital at Bethpage, New York. He's a professor of clinical medicine at New York Medical College. He is also board certified in internal medicine and infectious disease. He's the author of over 200 papers in peer-reviewed journals. He is also the author of a book called Visiting the Sick, which you can find in your local bookstores. And he has been a scholar in residence in multiple conferences. Once again, it's my great pleasure and honor to ask Rabbi Glatz to introduce the morning's topics.
Laser really has done a wonderful job putting together this conference. It deserves a big yasher kareth from everybody. Along with Rabbi Jay Kelman and the whole group in Torah in Motion, all the people on the organizing board have done. This is such a wonderful conference. It's an honor to be part of it. Part one, which is what I'm going to talk about, which you'll be able to follow along the slides in your book, is the brain death controversy. And what I would specifically ask, and I have an email to prove it, is don't revisit the lengthy debate on the subject, and don't go through all these sugyos in any great detail. However, try to make everybody understand the subject and show how the current machlokas evolved. And that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to give people a background. And I warn you right now, you may not leave this room with an answer, because there is no answer. I'm going to end up posturing right of Aaron Lichtenstein Shlita, which is a wonderful company to be in. And his ultimate result is he doesn't know what the answer is, how to paskin with Shaila. And Ani HaKotan, I certainly don't know how to paskin with Shaila, so I feel very comfortable being in the same group as Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Shlita, and others who cannot paskin with Shaila. I will show you a great list of Rabbanim that can paskin it one way. I will show you an equally great list of Rabbanim who paskin it another way. And I will conclude with something that nobody's ever happy with. It's a machlokes. And go ask your local competent Orthodox rabbi how to paskin. And therefore, what I was really asked to speak about is to get rid of the controversy in the brain death controversy and try to have this as a halachic discussion. Try to make sure everybody's familiar with the concepts involved in this discussion, but not to try to come to an answer. Now, some people like to walk out of a lecture with everything nice and neat. The previous lecture, people like to hear, you're absolutely this or you're absolutely not. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes halacha gives very good advice and lets a person make the wrong decision. Halacha is like that sometimes. It goes up to a certain point, and then it stops. And we have a certain level of bechira chofshi within certain parameters of halacha. And we feel sometimes very uncomfortable with that. But that's the way the halachic process works. There isn't a black and white answer on everything. With that little introduction, so you don't throw tomatoes at me at the end, why didn't I answer the question? These are the questions that I was specifically asked to discuss. So if you look in the book on page 69, the next slide, and I won't keep on saying look in the book at the next slide, but I'm just going to go through them. You go from left to right. It's an English sefer, not a Hebrew sefer. And then you go down. What is the definition? Why do we care why somebody's alive or dead? So there are a lot of obvious things. One, the soul leaves the body. That has certain halachic ramifications. When a person is dead, they're exempt from doing certain mitzvos. Even if a person is physically incapable of doing mitzvos, just the fact that you receive yisurim is a wonderful, wonderful thing for the soul. There's a famous drasha. I once said over, I think, on the Eila drasha. Why do we have suffering in this world? And that's because yisurim in this world, as difficult and as hard and as painful as they may be, are far better than yisurim in the Olam HaEmes. And the story goes that a person passed away, and he's being judged. He's 120. He's in front of the Beis Din Shamala. And they bring out all of his good deeds that he did, and they're represented by a white angel. And Baruch Hashem, there's a huge line of white angels. And then the prosecuting attorney, the Sitra Acha, gets up there and says, well, here's another huge line of black angels representing all of the terrible things that he did in life. And the black angel line far surpasses the white angel line. But then all of a sudden, one of the black angels falls down, disappears. Remember that little yisurim that you had when you had a little pain in your knee? Boom, that took care of that black angel. And then another Yisurim episode in his history, you know, when you didn't get Shlishi and they gave you Revi, Chas V'Shalom, Rachmana Litzlan, Lo Aleinu. Well, that black angel, boom, he just disappeared. And it goes on and on and on. He's getting hopeful. The black line is a little bit shorter than the white line. Almost, almost. And then it stops. And he's a couple of black angels short. The black line is longer than the white line. And he cries out, Ribbono Shel Olam, why did you make me suffer more in this world? Yisurim in this world, even if you're unconscious, can have a positive benefit. We don't understand. Don't ever come to me and ask me to explain how HaKadosh Baruch Hu works. I don't know. I don't have any inkling as to why HaKadosh Baruch Hu does something in this world. I know what it says in Shulchan Aruch. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I know what my Rabbanim have taught me, what I'm supposed to try to do in this world, and that's it. I'm not a deep person. I try to do what I'm told to do. Why? I mean, that's from people a lot smarter and brighter than me. And therefore, Yisurim is sometimes good. Suffering can be good for us. We don't ask for it. We don't want it. You shouldn't ask for it. We don't pray to be tested. We don't pray for suffering. We do everything in our powers to not suffer. That's all within halacha. But the bottom line is, Yisurim can sometimes be good. But once the nefesh leaves the body, that's it. So it's very important to know at what point the person is dead and all you're doing is nivul hames versus is this person still alive halachically and is getting benefit from being alive, even though they may not necessarily recognize that benefit or their family may not recognize that benefit. And that's a very important concept to understand. There are obviously halachas in terms of tumas meis. What point in time does tumas meis begin? Does it not begin? Baruch Hashem, and that's not nogeya for most people, but it is nogeya for Kohanim. It is nogeya for certain dinim even today. And Yitz Hashem, it will be nogeya very soon when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, and we're going to have to deal with these on a different, additional halachic level. There's a chiv to bury as soon as possible. We never delay burial unless we have a good reason to. Well, a good reason to if the guy's not dead yet. That's a pretty good reason. That's probably the best reason to delay burial. So you have to know, when do we have this mitzvah to bury the person as soon as possible? They have to be dead. That's the only absolute criteria for that. There is a prohibition against benefiting from the mace. That can be overridden, as many Yisroel can be overridden by a greater good in halacha, halachic greater good. And then, of course, when does the shiva start? These are all practical questions that one needs to deal with in terms of death. However, this talk will specifically discuss the halachic question of when can you harvest organs from such a person, because that is the practical medical ethics shaila, as opposed to all of these individual shailas that I've already alluded to. So you need to know, when does death occur? Now I know there is some overlap between the speakers. I've looked at their slide sets now. I'll try not to duplicate too much. And hopefully every speaker will have a chance to give their own approach to this idea. But basically, I came up with four potential definitions of death that are halachic. Three from primary sources, and one that potentially is from primary sources, but certainly is not definitively stated in a primary source. And you can see that the Gemara in Yom, which we'll talk about in a second, talks about a definition that requires the cessation of breathing. The Gemara in Yom also talks about a definition that could be requiring the cessation of respiration. The two are not the same. They often go hand in hand. When life is simple, they always go hand in hand. When life is not simple, when life is complicated, as in the ICU, they don't go always hand in hand. And then you have a Mishnah in Arlos, which talks about decapitation of an animal. Clearly the animal is dead. And then you have the question that makes the controversy, what is the definition of brainstem death? Now, in the United States, and certainly in New York, the law is that a person is dead when their brainstem is declared dead by the physicians. There is a rigid criteria that needs to be applied, which I will dare say and add a comment that it doesn't always get so rigidly applied. People can agree with that, disagree with that. From practical experience, I'm telling you, it doesn't always get so rigidly applied. So that's an important point to always keep in mind in this entire controversy. But let's even assume that it does get rigidly applied. There is, at least in New York state law, an override to this law that states that if the family objects to that definition of death, then guess what? The patient's still alive. So that's a very important protection that is there in New York state law to allow for the difference in halachic viewpoints between those that agree with New York state law from a halachic point of view and those that don't. Now, what does brainstem death actually mean? So by definition, it has to be the total cessation of cortex and brainstem function, which many have used the term of physiological decapitation. The tissue, if you look at it on a microscopic level, begins to necrolyze. It is irreversible, despite what people like to sometimes comment, and there are people that are looking to stir the pot on all sides of this controversy. Nobody has ever gotten up and given a lecture after they've been declared brain dead. I know some people that are brain dead that have given the lecture, but they didn't meet the strict criteria for brainstem death. Okay? If somebody is truly brainstem dead, they will not breathe on their own. That's also a vadai. These are facts. Can't argue with certain facts. If a brainstem dead person is halachically considered alive, so then it's ritzicha to take any of his organs. Ritzicha is a very strong word. I use it absolutely appropriately. It is murder. It is a capital crime, albeit one that might not be able to be punished with a beis din, because the person would certainly have the halachic status of being a treifa. And again, the Daf Yomi teaches you everything. Recently had a whole discussion as to if a person is a treifa, you can't kill such a person with beis din. So beis din may not be able to kill the person, but they still have the definition of being a rotseach, and God will get you. But God is a lot better than a beis din. So that's an important point to remember. If, on the other hand, the person is halachically considered dead, there certainly is a mitzvah and possibly a chiyuv to use that person in ways that are halachically permissible. And that's where the, quote, controversy arises. And that's a halachic controversy within the base mentorship, within the ICU, and it should stay that way. But the controversy about the controversy is what I'm going to speak about, which is absolutely wrong. And there's been, unfortunately, a lot of strong voices that come out on both sides that are A, anti-halachic in nature, and B, are potentially over isurim and causing tremendous damage to Klal Yisrael on both sides of the fence that need, I think, to be addressed and mentioned, if not solved. The Warren Yuma talks about if a person, Rachmana Litzlan, has a building falling on them on Shabbos. So what are you allowed to do to determine if the guy's alive? So if there's any chance that the guy's alive, halacha says we chuck the rabbinical issa of muktzah, and you do everything possible to go and ascertain that the person is potentially alive, and do everything possible, even for chai yishah, even for a limited amount of time. Has a tremendous crush injury, the guy's not going to make it to the next Shabbos, you're still allowed to save him that Shabbos and do all the Yisurim that you're permitted to do for Pikuach Nefashos on Shabbos. Clear cut, absolute, no doubt. Now, the question is, you find him, as the Gemara says, lifeless and inanimate, which Rashi says, not moving a limb, appearing as if dead. So, that's the definition the Gemara says. How far do you have to check to see if this is true? So you have one opinion that says ad chotmo, up until the nose, respiration. And you have one opinion that says ad libo, up until the heart, i.e. circulation. The question is, these are the two definitions that the Gemara gives. Where does brainstem death fall into this? You can turn to the next page if you're still awake. The Gemara in Yuma says that we have a pasuk in Bereishis that says that the breath of life is in the nose. The Rambam in Hillel Shabbos, Shulchan Aruch and Aruch Chaim, paskins this and say you're obligated to continue clearing the debris, being mechalel Shabbos b'fahesya. And I'll give a talk on Shabbos. One of my textual talks will be who should be doing this. Should you call the guy to do this, or should you call Rabbi Yashiv to go and do this? Who should be the one to clear and the debris and be mechal Shabbos? Shabbos Hutra, Shabbos Bechuyah. We'll have a chance to talk about that a little bit on Shabbos. But the question here isn't who should do it, is it you're allowed to do it? And you're mechuyah to it. Obviously, according to these poskim, breathing defines life. You do this until you can say that there is no breath in the nostrils. Many disagree with this, despite the fact that this is a Shulchan Aruch. You have great poskim that disagree with this. I listed a bunch in the handout: the Chassam Sofer, Rabbi Yossi Shel Natanson, the Chacham Tzvi, the Marsham, and many others. They disagree. I gave you some references there. I'm sure. Go look for yourself. For those that are really interested in getting involved in the sugya, they hold that if the heart beats, the person is halachically alive. Why? They base it on the Rashi. They derive from the Rashi. Rashi says, if any limb is moving, you're still alive. The heart, when it says limb, it doesn't use the definition of limb that we're talking about, your arm or your leg. Limb includes any part of the body that is, quote, moving. If the heart is beating, that is the equivalent, according to these poskim, of a limb moving. And therefore, while they agree that lack of respiration is often found and is consistent with death, that's not the definition of death. And it can't be used as an independent criterion. The only independent criteria of death are the absence of any of the limbs moving, which would include circulation. Those are the two definitions of the Gemara. In Yuma, you have poskim on both sides of the respiration-circulation argument. I'm not supposed to try to give you an answer as to which one we postulate. They're great poskim on both sides. What's interesting is the Mishnah Arlos. The Mishnah Arlos has to deal with a Tumah and Tara question. And people always say, why do we have to learn that type of stuff? It's not annoying today. And the answer is, I can't think of something that is more intrinsic to this definition than this discussion of Tumah and Tara. Because it defines at what point is the animal capable of being a nevela. Again, the Daf Yomi just learned the halachas nevela. Can you be metame with masa by touching a nevela? And the answer is yes. The person goes into Costco and he takes the hamburgers and he pushes them aside and goes and gets the kosher empire chicken in the back. So, if we were in a world of being noyik, Tumah and Tara, the person just became a tame by pushing the kasko on the side. He was masa, he carried the nevela meat. It wasn't shechted, it's not kosher, and it's also tame. So we're not knowing this, but here, this is very practical in life and death situations. Because the Gemara there talks about, the Mishnah there talks about, if you cut off the head of this animal, if you cut off the head of the animal and it's still moving, an animal takes a while for it to die. Even though halachically it's dead already, because there are numerous reflexes and their brain may be cut off in the body, but the body doesn't know it yet. It may take a couple of seconds to a couple of minutes. You see in shlachting houses, you see chickens running around without a head. That's the expression, which I was told more than a numerous times by my rabbeim, glad you're a chicken running around without a head. That's where they got that derivation from. And it's true, they will walk around without their head. What is their status? If you touch that animal, so you're metame. If you were the chicken, you can't just by touching it, you have to eat it. But if it was a behemoth and it's walking around and you touched it, so you're metame tumas nevela. What does that have to do with anything? So the answer is a brainstem dead person who is considered physiologically decapitated. We don't cut their head off, but their head has been cut off. By the demonstration of lack of blood flow, you're essentially, if you hold from this and believe in this definition, you have physiologically decapitated the individual. And therefore, they are halachically considered mates, even though they're attached to the body, even though there are signs. The chicken that's running around has a pulse probably for a short few seconds. So its circulatory system is fine. If you looked at its heart at that moment, it's still bleeding. Blood's gushing out the arteries. But the heart is still beating. But everybody agrees, based upon the Mishnah Arlos, that the animal is dead, is matami tumas nevela. So therefore, the question is this brainstem death equivalent to this or not? So, there's two questions over here. Number one, is it true that what I just said? Second question, I think, is much more interesting, which doesn't get any press. Even if you hold that the person is halachically considered decapitated, you have to prove that. It's not by visualization, like you see the animal without its head in the shechting house, but here you have to prove it. There's a separate issue of moving a gosei, so doing tests to a gosei. So gosei is a terminally ill person. Leave it at that definition. A really terminally ill person who's imminently going to die. We don't really define the ghost as well. There's a great postman that said, I can't define the ghost, but I'll know it if I see it. It's very hard to define what a ghost really is. Let's all give agreement that a person that's going to die shortly because their brain's in death probably falls into the category of a ghost. You want to argue that, fine. But let's say you agree that that person is a ghost. You're not allowed to move him. You're not allowed to do anything to him that's not for his own benefit. And proving that he's brain's dead, Lania's Dati, is not to his benefit. What benefit does he get from that? Other people may benefit. Why are you allowed to do an Isser on him to potentially benefit somebody else? Is a question, a legitimate question, that needs to be raised and asked. And the poskim do raise this. This can be found in Mishmas Avraham. Rabbi Dr. Abraham Shlita, who is a huge resource for anybody who's ever given a lecture from the Svarim, the Nishmas Avraham, as well as, of course, Rabbi Dr. Steinberg's encyclopedia on Halacha and Refuah. So these are wonderful, wonderful resources for anybody that looks to get a comprehensive viewpoint and not a biased viewpoint. So how does this relate to the brainstem question? So it depends. There's one of three ways it can relate. If you hold that cessation of respiration is what defines death, then brainstem patients, by definition, are incapable of respiration. And therefore, if you hold that opinion, respiration defines death, so then a brainstem person is dead. If you hold that it's a physiological decapitation, the Oholo's definition, they're also definitely dead. But it's not based upon the same source. It's not based upon the respiration cessation. And if you hold that circulation defines death, well, brainstem dead patients do have circulation. And they're not then going to meet the criteria of death. This, again, is a major fundamental halachic difference between the poskim. And it's legitimate. There is no right or wrong side to this. It is a machlokas of the poskim. We are Jews. We love halachic machlokas. There are thousands and thousands of shaylos and tshuvos that argue with each other. That's our nature. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to have, halachic discussions. There's nothing wrong with that. It's only when it becomes personal that God said, that's not what I was asking for. Beis Medrash, yes. Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai had the highest, highest, strongest discussions. But they never took it outside the Beis Medrash. Machlokis has to remain in the Beis Medrash and not outside the Beis Medrash. If you take home nothing from my discussion today and remember that, I will have accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. Even within Poskim, we don't know what they necessarily said. Moshe Feinstein's Atzal, the Posek Hador, has conflicting tshuvos, or at least could be read as conflicting, and I put them down in the slide. You can go through them in detail. I gave you the sources. One could read them differently. His son, Rav David Shlita, states that his father's position was stopping of breathing is death. Cessation of respiration is death. And it doesn't make a difference if the heart beats or not. However, others disagree. What even Rav Moshe's opinion was, and certainly there are poskim that say, even if Rav Moshe held like that, there are other great poskim that disagree with that opinion. And even on the definition of brainstem death, one can have a halachic discussion, does it fulfill the criterion alos? And the next slide lists six potential halachic scientific problems with the brainstem death definition equivalent to alos or not. And these include, if you have an intact hypothalamic pituitary axis, which brainstem death patients might have, does that meet the criteria of a physiological decapitation? If you have autonomic nervous system function, does that meet the criteria? If you don't have diabetes insipidus, doesn't that imply that there's some connection? If you have hemodynamic responses, doesn't that imply some type of a connection? If you have a stable blood pressure, doesn't that imply a connection? I don't know the answers to these questions from a scientific point of view, and therefore I don't know the answer to them from a halachic point of view. Coming to the end. You have on the next two slides a list of Gedolei Yisrael, contemporary Gedolei Yisrael, who hold that the irreversible cessation of autonomic respiration, autonomous respiration is death. This is directly from the HODES website. HODES is one of the sponsors of this event, so we'll give them credit where it's due. We'll also give them credit where it's not due. This is their listing of the poskim on which way they hold. There is disagreement in some of these poskim, but let's even assume that everyone is totally right. On the next slide, and this includes the Rabbanut, by the way, on the next slide you have poskim that clearly hold that brain death is not halachic death, because they hold that respiration is the critical factor. And again, who's going to start comparing which list is greater? By comparing the 27 Yankees with the 86 Mets, right? Who wants to say which one is greater? You don't get involved in these types of discussions. And even if you could prove that one is greater than the other, it has no halachic significance. We don't paskin based upon this guy is a little bit greater than that guy in my estimation. So you're stuck. You have great poskim on both sides. So what each side has to recognize is that there is a valid, legitimate, halachic viewpoint that might be different than your own. How can somebody say that they disregard the opinion of any one of the gedolim on these two lists? I don't have the chutzpah to say such a thing. I certainly don't belong on either of those two lists, nor do the vast majority of people that have the word rabbi in front of their name. This isn't a contest. It's not a vote. How many rabbis vote this way? Majority rules. Reshef the Shlita says that you need to have an understanding that Judaism is not a democracy. Because the majority of the people in the room think one thing, doesn't mean that that's what halacha says. And it's a very important concept. Not everybody is entitled to an opinion, which goes against secular ethics, which goes against democracy, which goes against what we're raised with apple pie. Sorry to my Canadians, I don't know what you use instead of apple pie. We use the... What? It's apple pie to say that everybody's entitled to an opinion. We respect all opinions. And that's true in terms of respecting people, but it's not true in respecting their halachic opinion. Not everybody's entitled to an opinion in halacha. I heard Rabbi Tendler once tell me, when a student in the class asked a question, it was a machlokes v'taz and mishach, and Rav Tendler, the student said, I think the taz is right. And Rav Tendler said, the shach didn't lose any sleep just now. It's not 2-1. Well, the taz and Joe Schmo, that's 2. And the shach, that's 1. So it's 2-1. Achay rabim lahatos. We don't paskin like that. So therefore, for me, or well, vast majority of rabbis to say, well, I think that this is what the halach is. When you have great poskim that go one way, what you do is you pick your posek, you follow your posek. If you're on the level that you're a posek, then you're entitled to an opinion. I certainly don't feel qualified that I'm entitled to an opinion in this debate. I follow what my rabbis say. But I also respect somebody else that follows what his rabbis say. That's halacha. Beis Shammai did not do what Beis Hillel did. Beis Hillel did not do what Beis Shammai did with full halachic permission. In the town of Riyosi, I clearly he'd invite me over for supper, I would have a chicken cheeseburger. Halachically, that's what Riyosi Aglili Sheet is. He's mechuyev to tell his talmidim to follow his opinion. They're allowed to follow his opinion. He doesn't have to say, well, everybody disagrees with me. At the same time, I can't pocket like Rabbi Yossi Aglili if that's not my Rebbe. If that's not my thing, you can't pick and choose. I think this is a good sheet to follow. I think that's a good sheet to follow. I say, L'charav, pick your Rav, but he's your Rav for all your questions. He's not your Rav for this question, then I ask this Rav for that question, because you know all the answers. You go do a Google search, and you come out, you could be doing every single Isser under the sun and find somebody that somehow supports it. Gemara has an expression for that. You can't do that. So each side has to understand there's a legitimate alternate side. And that's why I happen to like Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Shlita's opinion. He says, I don't know how to pocket Suffolk Nefashos on both sides. Here you are maybe killing a guy. Here you are maybe not allowing an organ to be transplanted into another person. And you're killing him. This is a tough, tough question. And the answer is, whether you like it or not, Eilu Eilu Divrei Elokim Chayim. There is no clear, in my very humble opinion, clear-cut advantage to one side over the other. I'm perplexed. I am uncomfortable with the medical as well as the halachic discussion to come to my own conclusion. So that's simple. It happens all the time. So I ask my Rebbe, what should I do? And he tells me what to do, and life is simple and fine. I try to the best of my ability to understand it. That's what we're required to do. But not everybody's opposed to it. I can tell you whether you have to say Yalla B'Yavu or not if you went back. But I can't tell you how to pass in the brain there, Shiloh. What I don't understand is how any side can go out and make public statements that are Chilul Hashem, that are causing acrimony, and what I put it into, who let the Sitra Achra into the base medrash? Who says you can do something like that? How can you publicly go and vilify or castigate other gedolim, or especially when these people aren't gedolim, and they castigate people who they have no right to castigate over isurim? We heard Rabbi Steinberg this morning talk about the famous Chofetz Chaim's 31 zisurim. That's all he pointed out in a slide. I'd like to reiterate that. That's when it's true. Over 31 zisurim, I say, Losa says. That's when it's true. Alachas kama v'kama, when it's not true, to go tell Lashon Hara, real Lashon Hara, in the vernacular usage, that it's not true. Real Lashon Hara is true. But when you're making up stuff and saying people are doing something that's about the person, that's a terrible thing. So I don't think there's any place for that type of controversy. That type of brain death controversy needs to die a dignified death. Maniyas dati. And the hope is that we can get to discussing all of these shilas in a fair, in a collegial, in a agudas achim type of fashion, and we can leave the room and say, I disagree with you, but would you come and sit down and have lunch with me and be my friend? Thank you very much for listening.